I will keep you posted on this tennis match. They're in the third set, and this woman, Laura Sigmund's up 3-2 on the number one seed, Sabalenka, which ESPN, and I think it's the USTA, the tennis group, continues to not identify Russian or Belarusian players with their flags or their country origin. That's been going on now for since the beginning of that war. I don't know. It's sports, but apparently politics seeps into sports. It happens sometimes, but we're not going to talk about politics and sports right now. We're going to talk Nats and then some football with Grant Paulson, of course, the co-host with Danny Ruye on the Grant and Danny Show, 2 to 6:30 every day on 106.7 The Fan, our sister station. I obviously thought about you. I did not get a chance to listen to you yesterday, but I really wanted to hear what you thought about what happened on Sunday after they got swept by the Red Sox, the firing of Rizzo, the firing of Davey Martinez. But before we get into kind of the, you know, the granular, I wanted to start with just a big, you know, macro, you know, big picture question for you, which is, have we gotten to the point, Grant, with the Nationals that we got to with our favorite football team, which is, as long as current ownership continues to own the team, it's going to be a long shot that they can actually create, you know, long-term sustained success?
So, Kev, I would say yes, with the caveat that we have seen this ownership group operate differently, albeit in its previous iteration before the death of Ted Lerner. And so I kind of look at the Lerner ownership group with two eras, right? There was when Ted was running the show, and even in the end there, when he wasn't all that healthy but was still with us, they operated very differently than since he has not been around and sadly now is no longer with us. And that's because there is some disagreement, from what I've been told for a long time, within the family and who's now left to run the team as to how involved they want to be and whether they want to own the team or whether they don't. And you've got Mark, who's sitting knee-to-knee with Mike Rizzo on draft night over the years, who's driving down to Fredericksburg with people to go watch James Wood after they trade for him, who's clearly very interested in owning it. I don't know, you know, how prevalent that feeling is within the rest of the family. So everything that happens over there is a debate and is a drawn-out conversation, and it's very problematic. So I would say yes, with the status quo currently of how ownership operates, and the infighting might be too strong, but just the different pages that everybody's on, the team's handcuffed, and it is going to be really, really hard. You're going to have to, like we said with Dan Snyder for a long time, luck box your way into a run, so to speak. But there is a path where they could decide at some point that they want to do this thing for real again and spend and get engaged and get invested. And we've seen them do it at a high level. We never saw that with Dan, and I don't think it was possible.
Yeah, before we get to that and whether or not you think it's realistic that they could revert back to pre-Ted Lerner's passing, the way they operated, isn't it just so much harder? 162 games, you know, no cap. You've got the Braves, the Mets, and the Phillies in your own division, the Dodgers and the Cubs and others in your own National League. Doesn't it make it even a longer shot that you could hit the inside straight and win 87 and qualify for a wild card in that sport more than it is in the NFL?
Yeah, I would say so. I think you're on to something. It's much harder to keep up with the Benjamins when you're not, you know, when I say spending and investing, everybody just thinks I mean going out and getting free agents. And that's part of it. That's a big part of it. You need to pay your players. You need to have talent, right? Everybody talks about these small market teams that are annually competitive. A good example would be the Tampa Bay Rays,
right,
who are right now within four games of the top of the American League East and a half game of the Yankees. And to your point, that's a division, theoretically, although I think the NL East is even supercharged from this with Steve Cohen and Philly's ownership. But with the Yankees and the Red Sox and even Toronto, who tried to sign Shohei and tried to sign Juan Soto and have given out big contracts, like, those teams are going to spend, and Tampa Bay is constantly in the mix. But when you really peel back the layers on teams like the Rays and the Guardians and the Brewers, who do things really well on shoestring budgets, they haven't really won anything. I mean, there is still a line of delineation between the haves and the have-nots and the teams generally that have a really good chance to win, and there's kind of a threshold with which you have to spend. But the one point I want to make really quickly is, because I realized after the show yesterday we left this on the cutting room floor, so to speak, I think when we talk about investment, or at least for me when I talk about spending, it's not just on the players. There was a piece I'm sure you saw in the Post last week where the Nationals do not have this state-of-the-art hitting equipment that Alex Call and some of their players wish they had. And this technology has now been used by most of the teams in baseball for 5 years. And Mike Rizzo came on 106.7 The Fan with the Junkies last Wednesday, and they asked him about not having it. And he said, well, we're getting it. You know, we wanted to make sure it worked. And he made he gave a reason or gave an excuse, whichever you provide, for why they didn't have it. But there's teams that have had this technology for 5 years. And this, to me, is just one example of what I perceive to be, I could be wrong, many areas where they are deficient when it comes to technology and data and the types of things that you need to have to keep up now. I remember years ago having a conversation with somebody after I had gone and seen the Wake Forest pitching lab, where they churn out some of the best arms in America and turn decent college pitchers into top five picks now, year in and year out. And I'm asking the Nats if they have some of this stuff, and they didn't. Now, most teams at the time that Wake Forest was cutting edge didn't. But another conversation I remember, the Giants were pretty advanced, and they used these, this is super nerdy, but like these biomechanics plates early on, or like pitchers' feet would land, and you could, based on the technology, figure out like movement and how to keep guys healthier. And I asked the Nats about it, and the person I talked to kind of scoffed and was like, no, we don't have that. Like, and I'm like, well, you don't want that? They're like, of course we want that. But the little things like that matter, and they add up. And that's the stuff we don't often talk about under the hood. That I think
that's not mindset. That's whether or not they're willing to spend for it.
Right. And look, to the learner's credit, and I don't get to talk to anybody from ownership ever. That's a big problem. Nobody does. There's very little transparency. There will be no press conference, you know, after a GM and a manager are fired in season. But I will say, to defend them in some way, it is possible that as an older school executive, especially early on, Mike Rizzo's leaned a little more on Mike DiBartolo's taking over now, who's a data and R&D guy. But it is possible that for a long time, the Nats weren't pressing for these things. Maybe Rizzo didn't as urgently want some of these things that, say, like an Eric Neander who runs the Rays might. Maybe Rizzo was, you know, I'm making this up, but perhaps he was more inclined to spend on advanced scouting and eyeballs and people traveling. And if it's Neander, they're going, no, we need this equipment. That's what I don't know. But I can tell you there are plenty of examples over the years that I have heard where there were things that they were trying to get and implement, and it took a really, really long time,
right,
to the point where sometimes you're years behind other teams before you do.
All right. Ownership obviously has a lot to do with their current, you know, plight, and really the plight of the last several years. But if you were just inclined to kind of look specifically at whether or not performance dictated this move, you know, Rizzo and Davey getting fired, can you make the case? And if so, make it for both of them.
Yes, absolutely. You can make that case. I think Davey's is way easier. The 2019 season was the exception for Davey Martinez. And specifically the second half of that year at 19-31, Kev, where I'm not sure how many managers in baseball would have been capable of winning that World Series. His positivity, his optimism, his day-to-day, the cliches and the stuff he puts on the wall that you and me and a lot of people that aren't in athletics for our life kind of roll their eyes at. All of those things really
tell
did
the truth
allow
Mondays.
Exactly right, yeah. The hip, hip parade, Jim Zorn stuff,
yes.
Right? That stuff is how and why they turn their season around. And I remember writing a piece years ago for The Athletic where I talked to not just players and coaches on that staff, but the people that have known Davey Martinez since he was a player years and years earlier. And he was kind of the perfect guy for that role. I think we talked a few weeks ago when he was in trouble, and I said, you know, 21 hours a day, I think he's a really damn good manager. He's a manager of people. He's okay in game. I don't think he, you know, is particularly great or terrible. But what I would say about Davey is he inherited a Ferrari. They disappointed in his first year. His second year, they won a World Series. COVID happened in 20. I kind of give him, you know, a pass. The 21 season was a huge disappointment where it all blew up and they started trading pieces off. And from 22 on, he has been basically given a, you know, somewhere between over the years, a 65 and 75 win roster to be a losing manager. But if you look at the ledger, there's a season on there where they were in the postseason and there's zero division championships. So these jobs are not had forever. You could pretty easily make the case, especially with them going in the wrong direction, the constant base running blunders with no adjustments, you know, the constant defensive woes. That one's easy for me. And frankly, I don't even know how much time needs to be spent on it because this could have happened at any point this season and it would have made sense.
And probably would have happened much sooner in other markets, don't you think?
Totally. Yes, yeah. I totally agree with that. For two reasons. One, I think in other markets there are higher expectations because there's like five markets that would rival Washington right now in terms of payroll, commitment. Like their total in among odds makers in Vegas was 70.5 wins this year.
Yeah.
Like I had someone call in yesterday and say, well, you know, you guys would give him so much more of a hard time and the New York radio or the Boston radio would be killing him right now. And I said, yeah, he'd have a $200 million payroll and a bunch of stars and they'd be underachieving. This is not that. He's going to the bullpen and deciding between bad option A or bad option B, and bad option B is doing worse. So it is a little bit different. But, yes, he would not be here because there just wouldn't be a 5-6 year window where they go, eh, well, we'll see. Let's
right.
trot this group out there.
So what about Rizzo?
So Rizzo's more interesting. So obviously the architect of a World Series champion, which you could kind of go on a run and that could happen and you could live off that for years. See Mike McCarthy, who's still talking to his teams about that time he won a decade ago. But it was not just that. It was the best team in the National League from 2012 to 2019.
Right.
And it was a proven – at one point, I would say right around the World Series, if you polled baseball people, Mike Rizzo's one of the more respected executives. I don't know that Davey's ever been that guy. And that's where with Rizzo, it's more complicated. Now, you said to make the case for why he'd be out, and it's pretty simple. Since the World Series, while I think the rebuild, thanks to the Soto deal, actually went very solidly without the reinforcements needed via veteran acquisition, the draft history is abysmal. The player development history is not good enough. He's always made up for that with great trades. And so he's been able to duct tape over and kind of mask those deficiencies with really a two-pronged approach. The trades, which he's as good at as anybody in maybe the history of the sport with his track record, and
really?
The money that they spent.
Hold on for 1 second.
Yeah.
Mike Rizzo's one of the best, if not the best, when it comes to trades in the history of the sport.
Well, I'll say this. Since I've covered the game or been around the game in 20-plus years, I'd stack his track record up with anybody's in terms of trades. Yeah, I mean, just to run through some of them. The Soto deal is the greatest return of all time. So you start with that. Now, he's also the guy that probably traded the best player at his age of all time, so you need to get a good return. But they've already got three All-Stars, and they should have four All-Star appearances between the three of them. And that's without Hassel, who's going to be an everyday big leaguer at some point, and Susana, who throws 101 and will ultimately be a closer probably, even having gotten to the big leagues. But when you run through the list, I mean, the Trey Turner, Joe Ross return for Steven Souza is an all-time return. Then there's little moves like Matt Capps for Wilson Ramos, who became their perennial catcher and an all-star. They got Doug Fister by trading a couple of Jags at one point in time. They traded a kid named Alex Meyer, who they drafted out of Kentucky in the first round for Denard Span, who became a leadoff hitter. I mean, one trade. Now, he didn't bat 1,000. You know, the K-Bert Ruiz, Josiah Gray return for Turner and Scherzer, well, probably not as bad as people think because Scherzer was a rental. The market was down. You still give up 1.5 years of Turner. You got a controllable catcher who started every season since, but he's not a good player. And Josiah Gray was a kind of a fluky all-star, frankly, who's been hurt since. That's going to end up looking like a deal where you needed to do better. But, yeah, his trade history is pretty astounding with what he's been able to pull off. But it has masked one of the worst 15-year draft runs maybe over the last 30, 40 years for an executive too.
Yeah. But like you said, I mean, he has at least on his resume 2012 through 2019, in which they went to the postseason 5 times in 8 years, won a World Series, and won more games, I think, than any franchise in the sport other than the Dodgers. I think they were second to LA. Correct. During that stretch. We're talking to Grant Paulson. Back to just kind of the last few years, what was more impactful to their current situation, the pandemic or Ted Lerner passing?
I'd say Lerner passing, with the information that I've got on how things currently work and just the structure now left behind with the family. I mean, the pandemic hurt because the family's in commercial real estate, and obviously their business took a substantial hit. And more importantly, I think directly, tangibly for fans, there was no celebration of the World Series, and the financials did change, but you were robbed of being able to be at the ballpark. All the benefits that you get from winning a title, they didn't really get. So that stinks. And normally there's money that comes in the following year as everybody's coming out.
Well, it's
ballpark.
A financial boon historically, especially when you win your first. They didn't reap any of that.
They got zero of it. But I would still say that based on, I mean, this is not just a baseball thing. Like the business part of the organization, you know, I'm hearing different people leaving constantly. I mean, just this week I heard another name of someone who was a high-rising person who a lot of people felt like could eventually be named the team president, who is not going to be with the ball club long-term. Like there are so many different elements to this with how it's going behind the scenes and the amount of good people that are leaving the organization. And it all goes back to the shift in structure post Ted Lerner, where there wasn't really a good plan. And as I said, I think you've got several family members who aren't on the same page as to what should happen. And do they want to own the team? Do they want to sell the team? And in a lot of ways they're stuck in sports purgatory. Yeah. Because nobody can figure out what to do next.
All right, so let's wrap it up because I do want to talk a little football. We're with Grant Paulson, of course. So will they change? Will they figure it out? Will they get it together? Will they get on the same page? Or are we sort of doomed to this kind of, you know, mid-market to even small market approach in one of the bigger markets in the league in terms of size?
I think to answer that, the last part of the question, I would say yes, very likely. Mid-market to small market operating is probably going to be the norm moving forward. But I don't think it necessarily has to be as bad as it's been the last couple of years. And I am actually hopeful that for two reasons, maybe things shift just a little bit. The first is maybe unrealistic, which is that in some way, like you're shamed into making a change. And there's not really a scapegoat at this point where you make the GM change, you make the managerial change, this search is going to tell everybody everything. And I think if you don't do something exhaustive and swing for the fences and spend legitimate money on grownups to come in here, then I don't know that you're going to be able to pretend that you're super engaged or care a whole lot or, you know, that you want to win, right? If they just hire a retread manager who wouldn't have gotten a job otherwise, or a general manager that nobody thought was one of the high-rising execs in baseball, it's going to tell you a whole lot. So that's number one, is I think they could kind of pivot to now saying, hey, we were always willing to spend. The guys just didn't think we were ready, and now's the time, and they'll go out and get a player or two, and they'll bring in a real GM. And I think they can kind of save face a little bit in that regard. That's number one. The other thing is, there is a CBA coming up at the end of next year, and there's a likely work stoppage. Some people are calling it an almost certain work stoppage looming in Major League Baseball. And I think there is a real chance that we're just seeing basically a dragging out of the clock, like a taking the air out of the football until then, and that maybe there would be a sale after that still. So I don't know imminently that like they're going to be the owners forever and ever. It's possible. But I think even if they wanted to sell the team, it would be really, really hard to do that because, as you know, getting someone to buy into a sports team shortly before you're losing games and time in your season would be a really, really tough ask.
All right, let's switch subjects. I think when I was on with you guys last week, I think you agreed with me that you feel, right, like I do, that Terry's deal will get done. before camp, they'll come to an agreement and it'll get done. Do you agree with me on that or not?
How could it not? Right? I mean, isn't that kind of, when you think about it, how you feel? Like, they preach every hour of every day about finding commanders. And they're drafting Johnny Newton out of Illinois, and they're bear hugging in the draft room because they found a commander, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Terry McLaurin is the lieutenant commander. You know what I mean? Like, he is the guy that the whole thing revolves around, and he is what you basically put on the board every morning and say, this is what we want you guys to be. And you've got him. And so I don't think you can preach all the other stuff, and then it's his turn to put his hand out and get paid and not do it and keep preaching about finding commanders. So I just think it's inevitable.
All right. So if it didn't happen, I think it will too. I think it'll happen before camp. I think he'll be in camp day one with a new contract extension. But if it didn't, and we got into a holdout, which, by the way, would be the most off-season drama we've had, because there's been no quarterback conversations, there's been no ownership conversations, there's been no coach conversations. If Terry McLaurin ended up holding out because they didn't get a deal done before camp, people would start to take sides. So my question to you is, which side would you take, and which side do you think fans would take? Terry's side or the team's side?
Fans would take Terry McLaurin's side. I think fans almost always side with the player. This is a little bit more nuanced because of the In Peters We Trust fandom, and the fact that, correctly, as someone who wanted Adam Peters to be the GM long before he was hired and thinks he's really good, I think people have a lot of trust in him, and there is kind of a blank check they've given him. Now, fans did the same thing to Ron Rivera, lest we forget, in Ron We Trust, back in 2020 or so. But I think the passion and loyalty to fans far exceeds that of the passion and loyalty to the suit-wearing, shirt-and-tie-wearing executive. And so fans will be on McLaurin's side. I wouldn't have a problem either way, honestly. In terms of picking a side, eventually, I guess, I would pick maybe the organization side if I could find out what the money was. Like, here's what I would say. If Terry McLaurin's willing to sign at 32 or 33, which I perceive to be the market, well, then I'm on McLaurin's side because that's what it costs. That's what DK Metcalf got. That's what he should get. And let's move along. I don't think this is realistic, but if he wants 35 or 36 a year, if he wants Jefferson Chase kind of money, then I would side with the team because it's bad business to give him the contract. And it's only a few million dollars, but if you're not able to meet in the middle, to me, I would go as high as 33 and change for McLaurin. Anything more than that, it's an outrageous ask. And coming off of a career year, I think it's a bad time to get back into bed with somebody on a longer contract that's not going to be able to do that year in and year out. I wanted nothing to do with Daron Payne after his huge season, as an example. I think signing guys after their career years when there's a several-year norm is not the way to go about it. McLaurin was unbelievable. The further we get away from last season, the more we forget the postseason and the big catches and the touchdowns. I don't even know how replicable that is for a guy where it's not about running free and being open. It's contested catches. It's making ridiculous grabs in traffic. And so I think the team's doing the right thing with a hard stance here. I totally understand him. I don't know what the money is. So if he's asking for 30 and they want to pay him 24, they're wrong. If he's asking for 33 and they want to pay him 27, they're probably wrong. If he wants $35 or $36 million a year, that's insane.
Yeah, I think what's one of the interesting things, and I've talked about it a little bit here recently, and I think I might have the answer as to whether or not this is really about a massive divide or it's just about negotiating style. You know, this is the first real contract situation that Peters and Newmark and company have had. I mean, they extended Sam Cosmi, you know, right before the season started last year, but that was not, you know, an urgent kind of situation. They moved on from John Allen. This is urgent. This is high profile, and it's their first. And we may be learning that just it's the style of this group to wait it out. It was the style in San Francisco, and Adam Peters may have brought that style here. And when training camp begins, we'll have a new deal and all will be well, and everybody will say, you know, it was all about business and we love each other. But I have a feeling it may lean more in towards negotiation style than, a real massive divide or confrontation. But we'll see. But I am interested if there was a holdout. Go ahead.
No, I think you're totally right about that. I actually think that the chances of that are very, very high, because it's not like, you know, there are certainly complicated negotiations where we don't know necessarily a player's value. I think the market has pretty clearly established about where Terry McLaurin should be. And I'm sure right. you've done this over the last yeah. several weeks like I have. But you go through the who makes what, and it is pretty convoluted at wide receiver because there are really good players who make less. Guys like A.J. Brown, you know, are slotted lower than they should be. And then there's guys that shouldn't be making what they do that make a little more. What the Steelers did with Metcalf felt a little crazy to me. So that makes it harder. But it's almost – I comp it almost like to the draft slotting system, where we can haggle over a couple of things, but we kind of know where you're going to end up. And to me, that's how I feel about McLaurin. I think 100% what's happening is just this is their way of doing business. But the last thing I'd say about that is, in business, and we know this, especially in sports, it's not always great to comp sports outside of athletics, but when you are Terry McLaurin, you do get a little more leeway, and you're going to be treated, you should be treated, superstars,
yeah,
bit differently.
There's a bit of a fine line there. Here's the thing, though. You can't pay somebody in business or even in sports for past performance. You have to pay them for what they're going to provide you. And that's where 100%. It is legitimately tricky, in that he's going to be 30. And then where does he really slot in among receivers? There's that part of it too. But no, I'm with you. Like, you can't make people believe that you didn't treat this guy
correct.
With respect in the right way.
Like,
so there is that
example.
Yeah.
Max, doing the exact same thing as you, he's going to hear from the boss sooner, right? Not to throw him under
yeah.
the bus. Me and the junkies aren't operating on the same rules. I do something, they do something. They probably have a little bit more credence or leeway or what have you. This is a situation to me where you got to be careful with a hard line if that's the play. This is your first chance to really show how you negotiate. But this is not Jerron Christian, to use a player from the past, right?
Wow.
I mean, so
yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be careful here with how you operate is all I'm saying. I think that this is being blown out of proportion. There's not a whole lot going on. Is there some acrimony on McLaurin's side? Probably. Is his agent trying to get out there that they're upset? Yes. Do I think early in training camp he's going to be at the podium talking about being a Commander for life and Adam Peters is going to be giving him a big hug and saying how much he loves him with his chiseled beard and his nice jawline? I do think that's what's going to happen.
Thanks for doing this. I'll talk to you. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Be good, Kev. Right.
Grant Paulson, everybody. 106.7 The Fan, 2 to 6.30 with Danny every day. All right. Whose side would you take? Terry's side or the team's side if, indeed, it became a holdout situation at the beginning of camp? 301-230-0980. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. Over Sabalenka won in the third set, 6-4. So, Laura Sigmund from Germany, who's become, I'm a fan of hers for the last couple of years. She sliced and changed pace and just drop-shotted her way to a one-set lead, and then she was up 4-3 in the third, and then Sabalenka came through and won it. But your boy won some money. I had three sets at plus 300 max at 3-1. And I had plus 6.5 games with Sigmund, and she ended up, you know, losing by 4 games net overall. So that more than covered the plus 750 for her to win wager. So won money on her today, but I was rooting for her to win. All right, enough women's Wimbledon tennis, but it was a hell of a match with truly like a major overmatched situation where somebody with much less physically at 37 years old was able to, you know, use her craftiness and her brains to push the number one player in the world to on the brink in the third set. All right. So I was thinking about this, and I think I talked about this yesterday. I think I brought it up with Max during a segment. We didn't take calls on it yesterday. Tommy and I talked about it a little bit yesterday on the podcast. I was thinking that if it actually does get to a holdout situation, like there really hasn't been a major great player since Cousins, and Cousins, you know, was a good quarterback, but the contract stuff hasn't been part of our, you know, off-season discussion with, you know, the potential for, you know, two sides at odds and a potential holdout in a long time. I mean, I guess you could talk about the Trent Williams situation, but that situation was really different. You know, we were talking about cancer and whose fault it was that it wasn't diagnosed correctly, etc. You know, there was a lot going on there. But this would be a legitimate holdout. I mean, Terry's not coming to camp without a contract extension. You know, he didn't show up for minicamp, so I would assume he's not going to come to training camp without a contract extension. I do believe that this current situation, which everybody's reported on, you know, all the national guys have reported on, they're far apart. Terry's side isn't happy with the way negotiations have gone. That was Jeremy Fowler from this weekend. I do think there's a really good chance that this is more about how we're going to see Adam Peters and company handle these delicate contract negotiations stylistically. It's kind of the way they handled it in San Francisco. They waited it out. They thought waiting made more sense, perhaps created more leverage, and then ultimately they would get deals done. So I think it's more about style than a massive divide. But let's just play the hypothetical July 8th Sports Talk segment game. What if we do get to the beginning of training camp and there isn't a deal and Terry holds out? You know, we just talked about that with Grant Paulson, and Grant, you know, added, and this is important, you know, how much context we would have in the moment would matter in terms of how we feel, right? If Terry's asking for a Jamar Chase or a Justin Jefferson contract, then that's just not where he is, you know, both in terms of the type of player he is and where he would slot among wide receivers. And by the way, his age, both of those guys are 25 years old. And they are two high-level elite wide receivers who will probably be in the top 10 to top 15 of all players in the league when we see, you know, the top 100 list that the NFL.com players list, you know, it's been coming out in, we'll get to that maybe next hour in terms of which players are on the list so far. I think they're into the 80s in the countdown from 100 to 1. But if we, you know, had information that Terry was asking for, you know, $35 million or more per year, you know, and some sort of, you know, four-year, $150 or $140 million deal, I think that would hurt Terry with fans. But if we also found out, but you're flipping it around, that Terry was asking for a DK Metcalf deal, you know, $33 million average annual, we'll stick to the average annual rather than getting into the years and, you know, guarantees, you know, the practical guarantees or the aggregate value of the contract. And, you know, that he thinks he compares favorably to DK Metcalf, and the team is offering something close to, say, Brandon Ayuk, you know, at $29, $30 million, then maybe we would be, you know, on Terry's side. So when we get there, if there's information, and by the way, you won't always be able to believe some of that reporting, you know, that would perhaps really impact the way we thought. But right now, I'm just curious, first blush, if we get to the July 22nd, the opening of camp, July 22nd or 25th. 22nd is rookies, 25th is veterans. I think that's what it is. Anyway, if we get to that and there's no deal and there is a holdout of Terry McLaurin, whose side are you going to be on? 301-230-0980. I'm going to tell you right now, I think I'd be on the team side. I think this is a delicate contract. We talked about it right from the beginning when the first report came out that Terry wasn't happy with the way things have gone. By the way, he hasn't, you know, asked permission to seek a trade partner. We haven't gotten that. I don't think we'll get that. It doesn't seem like his style necessarily. It might be the agent style. Who knows? But I don't think we'll get that. I do have a lot of benefit of the doubt and a lot of equity that they have built up with me over a year. I mean, going into this era, I was benefit of the doubt, Kev, because it had been so long with, you know, not being able to give this organization, anybody in it, the benefit of the doubt. They never earned it. And it was like, you know, let's see what happens with Josh Harrison, with the ownership group. And then, you know, and then they hired Adam Peters. And then they hired Dan Quinn. I think they had a really good, those were the first big moves, because 2023 was not their team. You know, they couldn't put an imprint, ownership imprint, on that particular team. We had to live out the Ron Rivera 2023 experience with Sam Howell, etc., in that just horrific season. But right when it started, it's like they got the top GM candidate. They got a head coach that they really wanted. Yes, that's who they really wanted. And by the way, what a staff and what a front office. And so, you know, benefit of the doubt for me also took place when they drafted Jaden Daniels at number two, because that's what I wanted them to do. And then all of a sudden, by the way, in the first year, they win 12 games, two playoff games, and they're within 60 minutes of going to the Super Bowl. So I would trust what they're doing. Now, some might say, you haven't been overwhelmed with their offseason. No, I'm going to take each move and I'm going to give you my thoughts on each move. And there isn't anything that they've done defensively that says to me, wow, they added talent that will upgrade the defense. You know, and that was the biggest issue last year. Now, I do give a lot of room for the possibility of year two in the same system with the current players and the few players that they've added for the defense to improve. I mean, defense just behaves that way. There's not a lot of, you know, there's just much more variance year to year with defense than there is with offense. But I don't want them to set a bad precedent with a 10, 15, 20% above retail deal. This is a tricky deal because of his age and because, as I've said before, Terry's a top 10 receiver. He's not a top 5 receiver. He just isn't, in my opinion. You know, when you finish 19th in receptions, 15th in yards, 32nd in average yards per catch, you're not a top 5 wide receiver. You just aren't. He had his best year. He had 13 touchdowns, second in the league to Ja'Marr Chase. He is great with contested catches. He's great in the clutch. I love Terry McLaurin. He's a really good wide receiver. We've been through this a million times. He's not Chase. He's not Jefferson. He's not A.J. Brown. I used to think he was every bit of CeeDee Lamb. I still do. I think CeeDee Lamb's overrated. I don't think he's Amon-Ra St. Brown. I think he's in that category of, you know, there are like 7 to 10 guys that are somewhere between, you know, 7 and 14, somewhere in that range, which is fine. It's a loaded position in this league. It's incredibly deep. You know, the DK Metcalf deal was an outlier. To give him $33 million a year. Now, he's younger. He's 2 years younger than Terry, 2.5 years younger. To give him, you know, 4 years, $33 million average annual. Now, they gave him $60 million guaranteed, just so everybody understands about the guaranteed money with Metcalf's deal. But the average annual seems a little bit out of whack for DK Metcalf, although I'm a DK Metcalf fan. I think he is capable at times of dominating a game in the same way the bigger, stronger receivers do it. A.J. Brown does it, you know, on occasion. Mike Evans does it on occasion. But I think I would trust the team, and I would be on the team's side to do the right thing. I would also, you know, day by day, be open to changing my mind, because I will tell you this, that what we talked about, what Grant and I talked about at the end, is important here. you don't want your first big contract situation to be this tricky situation because he's 30, going to be 30. Where does he really slot? But at the same time, it's Terry McLaurin. This guy is first class. He is a leader. He's so respected by everybody in that organization, everybody in that locker room. You can't, and I don't think they would treat him poorly in negotiations. I don't think that's the case. But you can't leave with the perception that you're not taking care of him. So it makes it hard. But I think to start, I would be on the team's side, and I would trust that the team knows what it's doing. Where would you be? 301-230-0980. I see we have a full call list. So everybody stay there. I'll start taking your calls next. If we got, total hypothetical, to a holdout situation at the beginning of training camp, whose side do you think you'd be on to start? Terry's side or the team's side? It's the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
All right, some updates from Wimbledon as Taylor Fritz has defeated Karen Khachanov in the tiebreak to advance to the semifinal, and Arina Sabalenka defeats Laura Siegemund in three sets to move on to her semifinal. And in the NBA, Devin Booker has signed a two-year extension worth up to $150 million to stay in Phoenix. He will be there through the 2030 NBA season. And Paolo Banchero has signed a five-year rookie max extension with Orlando worth up to $287 million. And the Pacers confirmed that Tyrese Halliburton will miss the all of next season with a ruptured Achilles tendon. The Nats. A new era begins tonight in St. Louis as former Nats bench coach Miguel Cairo will make his managerial debut for the team today, filling in after Davey Martinez and Mike Rizzo were let go by the Lerners. Tonight, 7:45 is first pitch, and Nats on Deck with Charlie and Dave at 7:15. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1, and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the streams and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that is what's trending.
You know what's out on Netflix right now? The new quarterback series. You know, they did the quarterback thing a few summers ago with Mahomes, with Marcus Mariota, and with Kirk Cousins. It's out again this summer, and it came out, I think it dropped last night, and it's Burrow, it's Cousins, and who's the third quarterback? Goff. They're the three. Be interesting to see the Joe Burrow part with Cincinnati rolling up massive numbers all year long and the defense not being able to get off the field. It'll be interesting to see Jared Goff in the playoff loss against Washington. And then Cousins with all the issues that he had after a great start to the season in Atlanta. We'll get to some of what's out there sort of preparing in prepping and promoting the Netflix quarterback series on the show next hour. But right now, just first blush, if it came to a holdout. Training camp, by the way, 18th for rookies, 22nd for veterans. My fault. If we got to July 22nd, veterans report for training camp, and Terry is a holdout because there's no contract extension. Without getting into what we would know and wouldn't know with respect to what the team's best offer was, what Terry was looking for, whose side do you think you would be on? I think I'd be on the team side to start with. They've built up a lot of trust with me, a lot of equity with me, and I would trust that they would be handling it the right way. Max, do you have a gut on who you'd be siding with in that moment?
So my gut tells me it all depends on that big number that gets reported. Because if it's close to DK, like you said, where it's going to be like 33, 32, pay him that already. Like, sign that with the quickness. Now, if he wants like 35, 36, we got to figure things out. We got to dial it back a little bit. But that, so it all is number dependent. But if that number comes out to like what we expected to be the DK Metcalf number, I'm on Terry's side.
Yeah, let me just say with respect to like the difference between 33 and 35 or 36, that's not really it for me. What it would be, you know, is Terry looking to get paid like Jefferson and Chase. Okay, Jefferson makes $35 million, but was given $110 million in practical guaranteed money, okay, over a four-year deal. Jamar Chase's deal, $112 million in guaranteed money. CeeDee Lamb, $100 million in guaranteed dollars. You know, if he's looking to get paid as if he's a top three or four wide receiver in the league, that's an issue. If the team's trying to pay him like he's, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15, that would be a problem. Because remember, today's overpayment is always tomorrow's bargain when we come to contract talk. But Terry's age is a factor in this. I just think at the beginning, I would be on the team side. And I just don't think they're going to blow this. You know, I think they will handle it the right way. There are smart people in the organization. There are guys that have been doing this for a while. Not as the number one guy in Adam Peters' case, right? So there is that. He did work for John Lynch, and he worked for others. And they've got other, you know, experienced contract people in the building. I like their overall team. I don't think they'll blow it. That would be the side I would be on from the jump. What about you guys? 301-230-0980. Let's start with John in Rockville. John, if we got to a holdout between Terry and the team, what's your gut now? Whose side would you take?
Yeah, I'm going to start off with siding with the team. I do want to preface this as I'm a Terry guy. I mean, if you watch his film, every single play, nobody plays harder on the field. I was actually just gifted a Terry jersey. But that being said, we got to look forward as an organization. 30 years old, I was looking at Julio Jones the other day. I mean, just looking at his numbers, his last 1,000-yard season was, I think, 30, 31 years old. I mean, he's starting to get up there, right? So we need to draw that hard line and see where it is, right? And if he's not budging and if we're not budging, we got to move forward and see what the best path is to, you know, have a, you know, clean breakup and, you know, get assets to keep building and, you know, building the organization. I do think that, you know, it's going to set us back for our short-term goals of being very successful next year if we lose Terry. So we got to think
about
that
as well. He's not going to hold out once the season starts. He's going to play for the I guess trade would become an option if it really became contentious. But he's under contract. And he'll be there will be fines piling up that you can't forgive anymore per the latest, you know, per that last you know, agreement between players and league.
Oh yeah. I was just talking in terms of getting a trade done before the season.
Yeah. I think the worst case is Terry just ends up playing in 2025 on the last year of his deal. I do not see trade being an option. Yeah. I think the team has leverage in that he's under contract, A. B, you know, turning 30 years old next year, if there was an issue, they could use the franchise tag. Terry's got the leverage from some leverage in the fact that they really want him this year and they want him to be happy playing this year. And, you know, there's this thought that he better get treated with a high level of respect in this negotiation. And, you know, for the lack of a better description, he needs to be taken care of. All right, stay on hold. Sorry, I got to get to another break, but when we come back, I'll get to all your calls. Lap, Steve, Ryland, Joe, DC, Anthony, everybody, stay there. Simple question. If we get to a holdout on July 22nd, whose side do you think you'll be on? Terry's side or the team side? Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980, the team980.com. You can also stream the show and watch it on the Team 980 YouTube page. When you get there, hit the subscribe button, please, and the like button.